Blog Talk Radio.
An emotional day in Clark County Court for a rape survivor and her supporters. The man she met on a dating app was sentenced to years in prison. Ashley Grahams joins us. Ashley, you were in the courtroom.
I was, Chyna, and the survivor I talked with today is sharing her story in hopes of showing others that sexual assault victims can get justice, even years later. And I do want to warn you, she does describe the night she was attacked, which may be difficult for some to hear.
A small but mighty group of friends and family gathered at the Clark County Courthouse on Wednesday morning, each of them waiting to hear how many years this man, Michael Bartolini, would spend behind bars.
One count of rape in the second degree.
Earlier this fall, Bartolini was convicted of raping a woman in 2021 inside a Vancouver home. That survivor, Aaron, gave an emotional recount before the judge.
That night, I wanted to move. I wanted to scream. I tried to move, but his body weight was on top of me, and I wasn't able to do anything.
She asked the judge for the maximum sentence, saying she's convinced Bartolini would assault another woman if he was out on the street.
I don't want to ever see him again, and I want him in prison as long as possible.
Judge Robert Lewis agreed with her, sentencing Bartolini to 7.5 years to life.
You seem to have a very limited insight about your actions that day. You're in denial about them.
On the steps of the courthouse, surrounded by support, Erin says she feels some relief.
I'm still going to look over my shoulder, but I know he's in prison where he belongs.
We know the jury got this right.
While there was some solace about the sentencing, advocates representing Erin claim justice could have come sooner if her rape kit was not stuck in a statewide backlog.
There was a delay in the rape kit coming back.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced in October that thousands of rape kits sitting on shelves across the state have now been processed. He described it as a step toward justice. Erin hopes her years-long fight will empower other victims to come forward.
It may have been hard for me to do, but that's fine. He can't do this to anyone else.
Now, Erin, the survivor you just heard from, says she first met Bartolini on Bumble. She's concerned there could be other victims of his in Vancouver and Portland. Chyna.
Ashley.
Good evening, and welcome to Spotlight for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart. Joining me in a few minutes is Dr. Kathy Mathis and the young lady that you heard about from KGW. Will be joining us as well. Spotlight for Justice is a podcast by the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Occasion, other known as NWCAVE. We highlight law, order, and seek justice for those that we highlight on this show. As you heard on the intro from KGW, Michael S. Bartolini received 7.5 years to life for rape two, a Class A felony in Washington State, for the rape of a victim on August 27th, 2021. 1 in 3 women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. Every 68 seconds, someone is sexually assaulted in this country. 1 in 6 men before the age of 18 will have been sexually assaulted. And the scathing statistic, 65% of all victims who had come forward and did what they were supposed to do said they received no help. And we're going to speak to a survivor that rapist expected to give up because the rights of perpetrators in the state of Washington allowed him his due process to continue to get continuances, thinking that the victim would quit, but she never did. And so I am so pleased and honored to have Aaron on the call, as well as Dr. Kathy Mathis. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you, Michelle.
Aaron?
Yes.
Welcome to Spotlight for Justice. Two and a half years, we have advocated for you. And for that amount of time, although you've done some media here and there, we were always told we had to prevent, you know, doing something so that we couldn't get a fair jury. We then couldn't do it because, you know, because it would ruin this or paint that or what have you. And so unlike the mainstream media, which Ashley Graham from KGW, Wright Gasway, all of them that have interviewed you, I know that our Advocacy Center for Justice is very upset at the fact that we know and have proof that there are other victims to Bordellini, and yet the police and the prosecutor's office won't release a statement where media will say police or the DA are seeking the public's help. If you've been harmed by this perpetrator, please call us. So instead, your attorney, Josephine Townsend, and our organization, NW Cave, are doing what we can for you in order to make a safe space for the other women come in contact with this man.
There's been a handful of other women that have said, oh my gosh, I know that guy, or oh my God, I just went on a date with him last month. So he was still on dating sites, even though, or, you know, this was back in October, but, you know, he was still on dating sites through this whole process. And I just don't think that's right, because he was actively looking for another victim. And in finding out that he has other victims, you know, one of them goes back as far as, you know, 20 years to, you know, her remembering him as predatorial, a creep, and supplying drugs and alcohol for underage girls.
Which, like, we know is true, because his police record shows that he was charged and found guilty, pled guilty, I should add.
Pled guilty, yeah.
And had to pay and had to, you know, go through all the stuff you go through when you plead guilty to a crime. But because he pled guilty, they lowered it to a misdemeanor. And but that was two times serving alcohol to minors. And yet,
well,
here comes a
caught.
Woman. He got caught. Yeah, he got caught.
Only
and now,
caught.
Fast forward, now we've got a woman coming forward that may have been one of those kids that he served alcohol to back then.
Yeah, I mean, and she doesn't, I mean, it was 20 years ago, you know, but this shows his pattern. This is his MO. This is who he is. He's a rapist. He's a serial rapist. And I know for a fact of, you know, two or three other victims that he has raped. But I get the, now being on this side, I get the fear of coming forward, because getting justice is very difficult. People don't want to believe you, and they don't want to help you. But all you want, all I wanted, was to get this guy off the street and not let there be any other victims. Because he's not going to stop until, he's only mad he got caught. He's not mad that he's in prison. He got caught.
He got caught. But it wasn't the first time, Dr. Mathis. He's been caught many times for speeding, driving while intoxicated, anger issues, judgments here and there from past employers, et cetera. And, of course, the courts look at it as misdemeanors. But he obviously has an anger issue, a drinking issue. He's not supposed to be drinking from our understanding, but he does and his personality changes. And he got caught and pled guilty not once but twice in the past for serving alcohol to a minor. And yet here we are 20 years later, and now a rape survivor called 911 and did everything right. What kind of a guy is this? Make us understand the mindset of this predator.
Well, these kinds of predators didn't become a predator overnight. And it starts way back in their childhood. And around the age of 3 to 6 years old is when they begin to perpetrate on other people. Research shows that a predator perpetrator does at least 360 crimes before they're ever caught for the first time or reported. That doesn't mean that people don't know they're doing it. It just means they didn't get caught or they were not reported. So in Aaron's case, this Michael Bartolini, she wasn't his first victim, and she certainly wasn't his last victim. We know through research that these serial rapists have many victims. And we also know that there's no cure for it. So, yes, they're going to reoffend, and they're going to keep doing it because they are very broken people. They have, from a very early age, used the sexual deviancies that they have, and they practice on different people, and usually in the beginning, because they're children, they practice on other children. They will molest other children. And if they get away with it, they keep honing their skills. And so by the time they become adults, they have a pattern that they use, their MO, as you hear on television and stuff like that. They have an MO. They have a certain group. A lot of them have a certain age group that they like to perpetrate on. And it's never the fact that they've done it one time. They've done it so many times, they even confuse themselves sometimes on their stories of what happened, when it happened, how it happened, who it happened with, because they have no empathy. So these types of individuals learn from a very early age to cut out their empathy. And a lot of them are psychopaths. And, of course, we know, we've all watched television shows where they've shown it, and we also know through research that a psychopath is going to practice on animals first, killing animals, harming animals, hurting animals. And what most people don't understand, it's not the sexual act in a sexual predator that gives them excitement. It is the build-up to that sexual act. It is the predatorial stalking, preying on their victim, grooming that victim to get them to the place. That is the excitement for them. That predatorial, I'm watching, I'm stalking, I'm grooming, and this person who doesn't even know what I'm doing, that's the thing that really gets them excited. And the sexual part itself is just, I've gotten my jollies, and so now let's just finish this thing. So it could be they use their penis, they use a bottle, they use a screwdriver, they use, all kinds of different ways to finish that act. And then guess what? They feel really good and wonderful. They have no empathy for the victim and what they have done to the victim. And then the cycle begins again. After they've had what I called a rest period when I was working with them, they then begin to have a need to do it again, and so they start all over. It's very cyclical. They have a pattern of it, and they perpetrate it. The thing that is really important for people to hear, and this is what I want to say about Aaron's story, is most survivors of that kind of event have a hard time letting anybody know for the reasons Aaron's already said. People don't believe them. But even when there are people who believe them, we have a system of what we call justice, which is not justice for victims, it's justice for the perpetrators, as already mentioned. But we have a system set up that is supposed to help these individuals. We always say, why didn't, you know, if you get into court, you'll hear, well, why didn't you report? Well, why should I? You weren't there when I did. Why don't you, you know, why didn't you call the police? Well, I did call the police, but you weren't there when I, when you were supposed to do your job. So let's take Aaron's story in particular. Let's just talk about it for a moment. The DA's office didn't do her any favors. And the DA's office is the department that is set up, that is supposed to be protecting the victims and the victims' rights. And this particular one did not. In fact, this particular one, in when you look at the paperwork and the documentation, this particular one said, oh, we don't want to prosecute this. There's not enough to prosecute. You know, all the things that they were doing to let the victim know, oh, we're sorry, you know, it happened to you, but too bad, good luck to you, because we're not going to do our jobs. We don't feel like it. And that's the attitude, whether they say it or whether they don't, that is the attitude that is out there. And then they wonder why people don't come forward if asked to come forward. Well, why should you if you have an attitude of you're not important? What happened to you that changed your life forever is not important. Well, yes, it is. And so every person that is part of this needs to take on that aspect when you're helping a survivor. Everybody needs to say, if this was me, if this was my daughter, if this was my son, would I be responding the exact way that I'm responding right now? And I'm going to say, if they did, I feel sorry for their children.
Let me fill in our listeners. Let me just paint the picture of. Go ahead, Aaron.
The thing about the, you know, being there to support the victim and to help them through this process and not diminishing the fact that you were sexually assaulted. Like, no, I was raped. And also to learn different ways to speak to victims, because being told that, you know, the only thing I can do right now is to not think of this and to not worry about it. And it
that's
doesn't behoove me to think about this. Like, that's not.
So it's not. So I'm going to ask you a question, Dr. Mathis, because let me paint the picture for the listeners, where a lot of the media that has done anything on this case has not painted the full picture. The full picture is that on August 27th, 2021, because Aaron swiped right and went out on a date with somebody she had been communicating with for a couple weeks leading up to this, she was raped. Rape is rape. Bottom line, as soon as she was able to break free and get out of that house, not even 2 minutes later, she called 911 immediately and was rushed by ambulance to the hospital, where she underwent over 10 hours of a rape kit. She pressed charges with a detective. She was seen by an advocate. And soon after, she was given a 2-year protective order against Bordellini. Only a few weeks later, Bordellini continued to communicate with her. She then was able to obtain a 5-year protective order because of that. Oh, 10 years. My bad. 10 years. 7 months. Now we're in April of 2022. I had never, ever met Aaron in my life. And I Googled Bordellini's name because he's been on my radar since 2018. And all of a sudden, a new hit on Clark County's website that there was a protective order for sexual assault. That got me very interested because I would check on Bordellini every 6 months on Clark County. So where there was a public record on a woman I had never met before, and as the founder of an anti-violence organization that has been instrumental in ending the backlog of rape kits in this state, I reached out to Erin. And I asked her, what is the status of your rape kit? That was my first question to her. And she said, you're the first person I have spoken to in over 7 months, and I don't know where my rape kit is.
And yet she had an advocate.
And she had an advocate. There was a DA. There was a police officer. There was all of that. Within 48 hours, we found her rape kit. And at that point, I disclosed to her that the rapist is my sister's boyfriend. What are the coincidences to that?
Mm-hmm.
I resigned from the FBI Citizens Academy Board of Directors. I resigned from Vancouver Police Department, and I took leave of absence on these committees I served on for those two agencies so there wouldn't be a conflict of interest. And at that, my mouth shut. Because my heart of hearts told me that prosecutors and law enforcement, based on what I had presented to them, that I knew about this creep, and I call him creepy because that is what my nieces called him ever since 2018. And so for me, it broke my heart to keep quiet, but I watched and made sure I was always around for my nieces, and I could not tell my sister because I honestly believed he was under an investigation, and I did not want to ruin Aaron's chance of getting justice. And guess what? It took 2.5 years to finally get to court. 4 days in court. A whole jury that he selected himself with his attorney. He lied under oath constantly to Judge Lewis. And ultimately, he was found guilty. I did not rape Erin. I did not know Erin. I did not lie on the stand. I never took the stand. But yet he threw my sister's name all through 4 days of court, and my sister, who I love dearly, has now disowned my mother and I. But to this day, I don't regret a damn second of it. I run an anti-violence organization where we fight the fight for our clients. And this hit very close to home, but this creep deserved every bit what Judge Lewis gave him for what he said, what he didn't say, how he lied. And now that we know all these other women have come forward, I know we've done the right deed. So before I turn it back over to Dr. Mathis and Erin, I want to remind the listeners, if you know Michael Sergio Bordellini, 51 years of age, from Vancouver, Washington, we would ask that you call Josephine Townsend's office if he has harmed you in any way 20 years ago to 2 months ago, whenever it had happened, if you need somebody to talk to about it, we want to hear from you. Please call Josephine Townsend's office, Townsend Law, at 360-694-7601 or visit jctownsend.com. Was that the right Cliff Note version, Erin?
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable how much in denial of what happened, the lack of empathy, the lack of accountability, and the lying that was said about me. I can't even be mad at it because it's laughable because of the things that were said. Like, anyone that knows me knows that those things aren't true. And it really irks me when people do lie. And I'm so glad that he was found guilty. And the judge was extremely fair. He listened to everything.
He sure did.
The prosecutor did a great job. He stupidly took the stand, which evidently his lawyer told him not to, but that's what narcissists do. They have to narrate. They have to control the narrative to throw the victim under the bus.
And that's what I was going to say, Erin. That's what they have to do because it is a tactic that all predators use to get everybody's focus off of them. So they will turn around and they will lie about, you know, their victim. They'll lie and create stuff. They'll get anybody who supports them to join them in that. And unfortunately, you know, people who are not trained and don't know how to work with that individual, they, you know, what they're doing sort of creates what's called a mental aberration, which is it is a detour from a normal thought process, and it gets them to think in an abnormal process way. So it's like, well, he's saying this, and, well, that sort of makes sense, you know, to me, because I've got to make this horrible thing fit in within my reality and my knowledge base to be able to handle it, rather than saying, excuse me, here is somebody here who not only reported, because you have the strength and the courage, and I want everybody who's listening to understand Erin has a lot of strength and a lot of courage to hang in there and go through this when she had people not be there for her who should have been there for her because of their own issues and problems and lack of moral responsibility to a victim. But a perpetrator is going to try to create all kinds of what we call gaslighting in other people by saying, well, the victim's lying. The victim, you know, it didn't happen that way. And what you said about him being a narcissist is so spot on. The dark triad traits of a perpetrator is Machiavellianism, psychopathy, they're psychopaths, and they have a lot of narcissism, and then there's sadism in there as well because he gets off on his predatorial grooming and building up and his conquest, so to speak, not the act itself. The act itself is not what gets him off. It's all the stuff that leads up to that. And so what he has to do is say, well, you know, I'm you all know me, you know, and people who don't know me, they're lying. I'm okay. Look at me. I'm normal looking. I would never do that. And that's where you get people, and Michelle, I was going to go back to you on this, where your sister and there's other people that will defend him because they have to create their own fantasy with their own cognitive dissonances that are going on. And a cognitive dissonance is two opposing thoughts on something. And so they have to make choices. People don't like having to make choices when it comes to a crime. Because we have been taught and we have been socialized that there's good in everybody. Well, I'm here to say, no, there's not. And that is a fable, mm-hmm. that is a myth, and that is a lie that we keep perpetrating and telling our children, well, not everybody, you know, there's always good somewhere. No, there aren't. There are some people who are so broken, and he's one of them, that there
mm-hmm.
is no it's good in
him.
Them. Yeah, nothing can fix him. Not even uh-uh. God can fix him because he's so broken, he isn't asking God to help him because he's superior. He's narcissistic. He's all-powerful, so to speak. So when we're looking at perpetrators and predators, we have to remember when they show you who they are, and he showed, he even admitted to some of the stuff that he had done. When they show you who they are, you have to what? Believe them. They're not lying to you on that part. He admitted he
had
done
it. And he's been showing everybody for years because we know people that – knew him 20 years ago in high school, and they said, I saw your post. This doesn't surprise me. He used to have to give drugs and alcohol to girls in order to sleep with them or date them. And it was like, well, if that was happening in high school and now he's 50.
Right.
I mean.
But that's what I was saying. They practiced their skills.
Yeah, you don't just wake up at 49 and decide to rape somebody.
Right, exactly. It's been going on for a long time. And again, I'm going to go back and say, you know, a normal person doesn't do that. A normal person doesn't have to drug people and give them alcohol and use an underage person who, you know, they shouldn't be with to begin with, but to do that, to have a relationship with somebody. But a predator does.
Or lock them in a room in order to hold them against their will.
Right.
Which he was locked in, and that's one reason we got, you know, why he was found guilty of rape too, was because he had locked the latch and she couldn't get out. So, and he's done this before.
Like,
go ahead, Erin.
And as the prosecutor said on the, as the prosecutor cross-examined him, she even questioned him as to, you know, and as, to your point earlier, Kathy, you had said, you know, they use bottles and all of this. Well,
uh-huh.
come to find out, in the evidence that came out in court, you know, he had gallons of lube, you know, and it was like a hidden, no less. And so that came as a surprise to almost everybody in the courtroom and even to Erin for that matter. So that goes to your point, you know, it's like he had done this before, and our gut told us this. So, and then to think that just because he's been prosecuted, he has, you know, letting our listeners know he has filed an appeal. But you know, good luck with that, because ultimately, you know, He is guilty, and nothing in our minds tell us anything different.
No.
Well,
go ahead, Erin.
Go ahead, yeah.
The judge was, like I said, so fair and listened to every single detail that was brought in to the trial. And, you know, even the way the jury, I guess, like, looked at me just intently, just eyes focused, because, you know, they you can feel, like, what I was saying. You could, they're, you know, I'm obviously crying up on the stand, and, you know, but then you have him come up afterwards trying to dehumanize, to re-victimize me, and to make it seem like I'm a drunk slut. And that, I know it's not true, but it's embarrassing to have, like, my friends and family hear that. And also the fact that they had to hear the 911 call not once, but twice, of me hysterically crying, trying to figure out where the cops are going to pick me up. Like, my parents didn't need to hear that.
And again, I, you know, people need to understand, and you're doing it so well, Erin, in explaining what it feels like, what it sounds like, what it is in reality to be a victim of such a horrible crime, and to have to have yourself have the spotlight on you when you didn't do anything. He did. And that's part of the problem of our process, is that not only did he perpetrate sexually on you, he now has, through the justice system, put a spotlight on you once again to have to go through all of that, so that law enforcement and the judicial system can do their job by what? Unfortunately, the side effect is re-victimizing the victim in order for them to be able to do some of the stuff that they do, which is, or I should say, which should be changed. Why are we making a victim prove they're a victim? We should be making the perpetrator prove they didn't do it. The focus should always be on him. The spotlight should always be on him. And
they said,
and
he said, she said. And you don't hear if he said, she said mugging. It's an open and closed case.
Right. And therefore, when it's a he said, she said, they go, well, we have to have enough evidence. So we have to help, you know, those of us in the advocacy field, we have to help a victim prove they're a victim in the court system, where, you know, most everybody doesn't understand that the court system was set up from the initial beginning to protect perpetrators. It was set up to protect somebody who somebody else accused of something.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no, you know, the process right now and the way that it's done is not there for a victim to get justice. A victim doesn't get justice. You know what the victim does get? Conclusion. There is no closure ever for a survivor of a crime. But there is a conclusion when that perpetrator is put away where they should be, behind bars, where they've been convicted and everybody now knows them for being the sicko that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that is who they are. And then everybody goes, oh, you know, well, she'll get over it. You know, she'll move on with her. I'm sorry. Trauma stays in your brain forever. You never get over a trauma, ever. So people need to understand that are listening to this.
Dr. Mathis, how would you explain, and I get that his family is shocked and surprised, or what have you, or believe in his innocence. I understand they're hurting, so I'll put it out there like that. As well as my sister, who still, from my understanding, believes in his innocence, obviously. But how do you explain?
He's going to get away with it.
Right, exactly. And so how do you explain the... Go ahead, Erin.
He didn't tell his family or anyone because he thought he was going to walk away and get away with it. And that's what he had said.
But how do you explain family members that believe so much in his innocence, despite the fact that the evidence was so scathing? The 911 call, the... hours of interview that was recorded by police, then all the evidence shown in court. Before we go further, Jessica Smith, the prosecutor on the case, did a fabulous job. It was almost as if you were watching CSI or some Law and Order, television show, the way she put the entire case together. And it was very strong and well organized. and presented.
Okay, but I want to.
And the jury. And the jury. Hold on, Kathy. And the jury obviously saw that, like the rest of us in the courtroom. But how do you explain everything that transpired between then and sentencing, that his family would attack Aaron and me publicly? That is really going over the line. But how do you see that, the way that they attacked us and defamed us publicly?
Okay, I'll answer that. But then before I answer that, I want to go back to the prosecutor. When you said she put together masterfully this case wouldn't have gotten to where it did had they not had an advocacy group pushing and making sure the rape kit got through, et cetera, because they weren't doing their jobs. This case got to where it was, not because the prosecutor got on board and said, let's do this, let's make this happen, let's get this perpetrator off the street. They had to be pushed into doing their job, which is part of the problem with prosecutors' offices who have lazy people working there and who don't do their job to be an advocate and a voice and an attorney that is supposed to represent a victim. So once she was pushed and prodded and got in that direction, yeah, she stepped at the plate, did a good job. Well, good for her. But again, I'm going to go back to, why do we have to push and prod a prosecutor's office? If they've got advocates there, why weren't the advocates also helping out and doing their job? It's because they have a prosecutor that's not allowing them, either that or they're undertrained and don't know what their job is, and it takes an outside agency to push and prod. That's unacceptable. A prosecutor is put there to do a job, and that is to be the voice for the victims that they are taking cases on. But when they choose not to do their job and not to take a case, that's not a good prosecutor.
No.
So do you think it's every case, or do you think it's this case because of my involvement, and they thought, you know, it was a witch hunt or whatever?
It doesn't matter what they think. It's, are they doing their job? I don't care what they think. When you take on to be a prosecutor in a prosecutor's office and you have attorneys and you have advocates, you better do your job. Otherwise, get out of that office and let somebody get in and do the job. Your thoughts don't matter. Your duty matters. Your commitment matters. Your oath of office matters to serve the people in your county. I don't care what they're thinking.
The victim,
I want to
feel,
know
like
what
they're
doing.
The criminal.
Yeah, exactly.
And I agree with
that
because, you know, our Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, was quoted as saying, we are the people's law firm. And if that's the case, then why is that courthouse not protecting the victims? She has a protective order in place for 10 years. We're at his arraignment. He sits right in front of her parents and her. And both myself and our other advocate went and told the clerk, and the clerk comes back and says, can she stand out in the hall? Because we don't want to disrupt court. And that's what happened at his arraignment. And then let's also talk about the arraignment too. Because I've had this talk with,
I want to answer your other, before Michelle, sorry, but before you go on, I want to answer the questions that you asked me. So first of all, I don't care what a prosecutor's office think. I want to know what they're doing about it. Okay, because everybody has biases and everybody gets lazy and everybody gets tired and everybody gets burned out. I don't care about that. You take on a job, you do your job. That's number one bottom line. As far as the family turning against you, what happens with family members is they have what's called willful blindness. They choose to be blind to the fact that he's a perpetrator. And the only thing that they can do in managing that willful blindness
is to blame the victim and to point fingers at anybody helping the victim. They're angry. They're upset. But are they going to do that to their family member or the one that they love? No. The only other recourse then is to point a finger the other way and get mad at the other people. So, of course, they're going to talk and they're going to say, you know, Aaron was this and you were this and anybody helping Aaron is, you know, whatever, because they have no other direction to go except what? Admitting that their family member and the person that they love is a sick criminal, convicted, not only a one-time criminal, he's a multiple because he's a serial rapist, and they cannot. It's really hard. I mean, stop and think about it. If you love your brother or you love your sister and they go out and they serial rape other people, and we already know there's no such thing as a one-time rapist. They're serial. There's multiple people out there. But you love that person. That's where the cognitive dissonance comes in. How can I love this person who is so horrible and who's out doing these things, and yet I love them? And so your brain makes you twist all of these different thoughts and turn it into, well, I still love them. I have to be mad at these other people because I love him, and I'm not going to what? I'm not going to distance myself from him because I've known him for so long, sometimes all my life, and I'm going to what? Continue to love him. That means now that I have to defend him. If you love somebody, you need to defend them rather than love them enough to get them help. Love them enough to force the consequences that they've created, not the victim, but that takes a person who themselves is healthy. And most family members of perpetrators are not healthy. And most families who are in love with perpetrators are not healthy. So their only recourse is to do what they all do, which is to turn a finger and point a finger elsewhere, because I love, and they put love and defending in the same pot. They don't know what love is, because if they knew what love is, they would want good for the perpetrator and ensure that that perpetrator, number one, accepts the consequences for their behavior and get them into a place where they have lifelong therapy, because there is no cure. So they need to be, these perpetrators need to be wearing an ankle monitor when they come out for the rest of their lives so we know where they are. And their victims should be able to wear those bracelets that if they break a restraining order, that bell goes off on the victim's bracelet to warn them that your perpetrator is somewhere close to you and you need to call the police and have them arrested again.
Why is that such a hard thing to do? Because we can track Amazon, we can track Uber Eats, but we can't track someone who is a perpetrator and coming after us.
Yeah, well, it's not that it's hard.
Well, screw your rights, because you took my right away to say no. So you have no rights now. You wear this ankle monitor, and if you're in my vicinity, I can get in my car and leave.
But what it boils down to, Aaron, is this: money. Those ankle bracelets and those wrist bracelets are money, and the county and the state are not willing to pay for it, number one. There are some states that do. There are some states that don't. My feeling on it is the perpetrator should pay. Why should a state pay, you know, for a perpetrator when that should be part of the consequences of being a perpetrator and raping people and being a predator? You're, you know, for the rest of your life, you're going to be paying every month for that monitor. And if you don't, guess where you go? Back to prison. There's no,
you know,
today no
is today is Super Tuesday. And so the prosecutor's office, the district attorney, is an elected position. And so I'm here to say that whether it's our county or any other county across this country, let alone the state of Washington, we need, as residents and taxpayers, to understand the significance of constantly electing officials throughout whatever position you're casting your vote, and holding them accountable before you give them your vote, whether it's a prosecutor to, you know, to a judge, to whomever. But in this particular case, during his arraignment, you know, somebody at city council or somewhere in one of these cities around us had said, what could they do better? And I said, well, first of all, when you have a prosecutor who knows the case, like Ms. Smith, but yet you have a deputy prosecutor actually taking care of hearings and dockets for masses of cases, and you have Bordellini come up and his court-appointed lawyer says, well, this is his first offense, Your Honor, blah, blah, blah. And the judge has nothing, she has nothing in front of her saying either yes or no to that. And she says, well, it has been almost a year. And then the attorney does not correct her. Now, the prosecutor, the deputy, the person that sits in for the prosecutor had asked for $50,000 bond during his arraignment. And then when the judge said, well, it has been almost a year, what's the state's position? The state didn't say anything to defend their $50,000 ask by saying, well, Your Honor, it has been almost a year, but the victim did everything right by calling 911, going to the hospital. She has a protective order, and in fact, he just sat in front of her and broke that protective order. He's not saying any of that because he doesn't know any of that. And then the judge doesn't know that, and then she lets him go to process and then released on his own at zero bond. So when somebody asks me, what can we do better? And this is just one case N.W. Cave has been so a part of for so long. But there's more errands out there here in Clark County that are falling through these same cracks. How can we help the prosecutor's office do better when we're all on the same side of the law and want the same thing, but yet when they've been invited to attend, which we're at our No More Week, we're in the process of doing a 40-hour, three-day training that we invited them to attend, and they didn't send anybody to the training. How can we help somebody that doesn't want any help?
Well, that's part of the problem. Part of the problem, you said a couple things there that are really important. First of all, before anybody votes for a district attorney or a judge, you should do your research on them. You should be finding out what kind of a district attorney do you have, what kind of a judge do you have, et cetera, et cetera. And most people don't do that. They'll just go, oh, they're all about the same. I'll just, you know, whatever, and check it off without doing any investigation on is it a good judge, is it a good attorney, et cetera. The second part of that is most district attorneys and most attorneys don't use experts. What does that, you made a statement, oh, the judge says, well, it has been a year. What has a year got to do with it? It has nothing to do with it. This is a predator. This is a predator that there is no cure for, no help for, that an expert could say they have been what? The 360 times they've perpetrated on somebody before they're ever caught? What does 1 year have to do with anything? It has nothing to do with it. It is an excuse, and it's an expression that they come up like, oh, well, it's been a year, and you know, we should give him a break. Why? When we know that this perpetrator is sick, this perpetrator is broken. This perpetrator has at least 360 other victims out there. I want that minimization that the legal system does for a perpetrator to get out of their vocabulary. And that won't get out of their vocabulary until they start using experts like myself and other people that can help them, educate them, and get that has nothing to do with anything. Let me tell you about this guy. This guy's a sexual predator.
He's a serial sexual predator. I know more about that than you do. You know the law and only the law. You don't know much more than that. But I do because I work with them. I'm with them. I know their mindset. I know what they do, et cetera. But it's hard to get people who think they're God, which is the legal system, to use an expert because they think they know everything. And it's really difficult to break that thought process. If you have no consequences, you can do whatever you want to, and who cares whether you use an expert or not, because nobody's going to stand up and say to you, you know what, you really screwed that up. You didn't do your job right. So when we invite the district attorney's office, and we know they've got advocates, we also know they have advocates that are not allowed to do their job, or they're undertrained because they're not doing their job, and we hear from the victims that go through there, and the advocates do not help them. There's two reasons for that, one being undertrained, and one, we have a district attorney that won't let them do their job. Because the district attorney is also undertrained and doesn't use the resources out there to help them be the best district attorney ever. And that is a problem. It's a mindset within that particular district attorney. Because not all attorneys, you know, are like that. There are a lot of attorneys out there who bring in the experts to help them do the best job possible to win the cases for their clients because they know they don't know all of the other stuff. They know law. They know mm-hmm. some of the law. They don't know all the law. So to try,
we had
to get
a great partnership with the. We had a great partnership with the district attorney in San Bernardino for years. He was.
Oh yeah, but
he was spot on, and he would bring us in, and work with us, not against us.
Because he was enlightened. He was open to that. He didn't have that narcissistic ego that says, "I don't need you. What do I need you for?" He worked in cooperation, understanding all of us who are supposed to be on the same side should be working cooperatively for each victim that comes in so that, what, they can win in court. This is not about one person's ego. This is about all of us working together so that a victim like Erin feels free to come forward knowing that she's got a team of collaborative agencies and advocates and experts working on their behalf for that district attorney and prosecuting office so that they can go in and win their cases. But when you have ego in the way, that prohibits that cooperative process. And even when you reach out and say, we want to be a part of, we want to work with you because we know we're stronger that way. And we do our jobs for victims that way. But if you have a person that's got an ego issue and an ego problem, and they're undertrained, they don't see the benefit of all of that. And that's unfortunate because here in this county, especially in Clark County, we should be working always with the district attorney's office. We have experts that they can call in. We have experts that will testify them. NWK, you know, we are a coalition. We have a lot of different people that we can bring in and help them with their cases. But guess what? That door has not been opened because there's an issue from the other side saying we don't need you.
We did invite them also to the crime lab tour yesterday at Washington State Patrol, and they didn't come to that as well. Before we go further, I wanted to let the listeners know, beginning March 3rd through the 9th this week is No More Week, hashtag No More Week with the No More Foundation. The No More Foundation, we have been a member, a chapter of theirs. We represent Washington State through our program, Washington Says No More. And it's a collaborative effort of over 1,500 allied organizations and chapters globally. And we are so honored that we are the chapter for Washington State on ending domestic violence and sexual assault. Just a couple stats that they have shared with us. There has been over 31,000 downloads of their prevention toolkit. There has been over 202,000 downloads of their healthy dating guides.
So if you're looking for help and hope, visit visit nomore.org. That's nomore.org. Or you can always visit nwcave.org/help for a list of national hotlines and local contacts for what you may be going through. And again, we're speaking with Erin in regards to her case, and if you have been assaulted or you have anything that you would like to contribute as far as a discussion with Josephine Townsend, please visit jctownsend.com or call Townsend Law at 360-694-7601. And you can stay anonymous. We are just building the second phase of what we already knew was the situation in Erin's case, and that is she was raped by a serial rapist. And we will prove that, just like Erin and the DA proved that back in December when he was sentenced to 7.5 years to life. Closing out this week, we are live, coming to you live from the Heathman Hotel, the Heathman Lodge in Vancouver, Washington, where we are doing our advocate certification training for 3 days. And then we close out the week for our Java for Justice brunch with keynote speaker Elizabeth Smart. And we are so thankful to all of our sponsors that have made this week possible on so many levels. Alaska Airlines, Umpqua Bank, Online Support, Tech Services, Utopia Salon, Business Sense, Blue Door Bakery, Heritage Bank, California Cognitive Behavioral Institute, TIP Northwest, WEO, EO, EOCF, Fierce Feisty Feminist Women, Clark County Sheriff's Office, Morrell Inc., A Sunset Design, Vancouver Family Magazine, MMM Productions, The Columbian, KXRW, and KGW, which you heard Erin's case on the intro. So now that I got all that out of the way, we have a few more minutes. Erin, where are we at on your case now where we're working on the next step of what you need so that you can get the help you need from what has happened to you?
Right now it's working on the victim restitution. And, you know, it'd be helpful to victims to know the difference. There's victim compensation program, and then there's victim restitution, which is a criminal, and then there's, you know, a civil suit. You can sue the person. So just getting everything together for that, and I'm also in limbo waiting for, you know, an answer whether it's going to be appealed or not, which I don't think it will, but there's, you know, there's always that little notion that, you know, it just might happen. And then I got a letter in the mail asking me if I wanted to join the ALB, which is the Accountability Letter Bank, which basically gives the perpetrator, the defendant, a way to write me a letter. They write their victims a letter taking accountability for the trauma and the pain that they caused. And it's just one more thing that's traumatizing to me. it's like, I don't want to hear from this person. What makes their accountability letter mean anything? They've been lying through the whole process. To them, this
Dr. Mathis, how do you explain the fact that she has a lifetime or a 100-year protective order now? Why would the state want him to contact her knowing there's a protective order against him?
Ignorance and undertraining. Because that's the most ridiculous thing on the face of the earth, is to have a perpetrator write a letter to a victim. As Aaron just said, they're liars. If their lips are moving, they're lying. So why on earth would you have a letter from a perpetrator go to a victim of a crime to re-victimize them and to give that perpetrator one more opportunity to have power and control through whatever they wrote? And the victim knows that the person's lying. It means nothing to a victim. It's the most ridiculous thing that I've ever heard of. And so it should be a law that that perpetrator, that's not a consequence for the perpetrator to try to, you know, have contact with a victim. That's a consequence to a victim to be re-victimized. So that needs to go away. That needs to be changed. That needs to be something that's removed from Washington's law that says, you know, a perpetrator gets to do that. Because that perpetrator is sitting back there going, oh, good, I have one more opportunity to have a little power and control, or the other term that's flying around now, coercive control, over the victim. That's absolutely asinine. That comes from ignorance.
I couldn't believe that I got that letter.
Yeah. I would like to write a letter to him. Okay, you know, and of course, most victims don't even want it. They want no contact.
Yeah.
They've been victimized.
Which is what
I have
for 100 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, no, that's just ignorance on the part of the Washington State to have that in place.
I was speechless and still kind of am. Like, how... And I talked to a friend and they said, you know, it may be healing at one point, but for me, no, I want nothing to do with it. I don't care if you're taking accountability for right now. You're doing it because it's court ordered or it's part of your, release or whatever, because with the rape and the second degree in Washington, it comes with the automatic ISRB. They have to appear in front of a parole board to ask to be released. And there's terms and conditions upon the release. They can't go to bars or have a phone or whatever the case may be. But
well, as you said, there is that letter, let's just say it as it is, that letter has nothing to do with healing. That letter has to do with a requirement that perpetrator has to fulfill to what? Get back out at some point in time? So it has nothing to do with the healing process at all. So therefore, if it has nothing to do with healing, it has nothing to do with accountability, even though it's used as that, it has nothing to do with accountability. Where was the accountability before they did the act? You don't give accountability on something like a letter after the act.
Yeah, after you've had ample time to say the truth and you continued to lie and the story's changed I don't know how many times. And then going to even the fact of body shaming me.
Yeah.
To say that this didn't happen and stuff like that. And it's like...
Yeah. Well, and then again, it plays right into the hands of a perpetrator. It doesn't help a victim at any point in time do anything but have to one more time, what? Have some connection to this perpetrator of a crime as being, you know, as part of their accountability. Well, they're not accountable. They won't be accountable. How many people come out of prison reformed? Not many.
Close to none.
Mm-hmm. They in fact, they just learn more in prison so that when they get out, they have more skills to use to perpetrate. So our whole system is, again, screwed up. They don't understand the dynamics of being a victim and what that means to any contact with a perpetrator or anything else. Perpetrators, as far as I'm concerned, and these are sexual predators that I'm talking about specifically, should all be put on an island out in the middle of the ocean where they cannot get away and nobody can get to them, and let them have at each other. Because
I think that's called Alcatraz.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what they should do with them. They should put them out there and let them have at each other, because you cannot cure them. They are broken forever. And there is no rehabilitation for people whose brain template's broken.
That's true. And why is it that when someone's convicted and they're sentenced, currently in prison, that they aren't automatically put on the sex registry list? Like, he won't until he, you know, is up for parole. But, like, why can't it be on now?
Yeah, because, you know, again, because a lot of times they think because he's behind bars, he's safe and he doesn't need to be exposed until he's what? Back out in the public. Well, let me say this, because you make a very good point, Erin. If we're not exposing them for who they are from the very beginning, why
mm-hmm.
is it okay to expose them later on?
Yeah.
What, you know,
again,
what difference does it make? That they
yeah,
should be
again,
exposing them now.
The perpetrator.
Yeah, right, exactly. So
and besides, with the way everything's going on these days and the way people are pardoning everybody and letting prisoners out, then they let him out and he's not on the registry until after he's processed. So then if he gets out, then he's on,
mm-hmm.
he's on the loose. It makes
and
no sense.
Can, you know, they can, you know, not register. And there's been time, you know, I've heard of that people don't register. And then they're on, you know, they're free. And it's like, he is a predator. Like you said, he's not going to stop.
No.
He needs to be on there now. What's the hurt of having his name on there now? None.
There isn't any. Like I said,
especially, let's face it. He. We know he raped you. We know, based on what others have told the attorney and you, what happened
mm-hmm.
with them. And all of this while still in a relationship with somebody in my life. So what makes us think that 7.5 years behind bars is going to make him not want to be in a relationship when he gets out? He is going to seek prey.
He was on trial for rape, too, all while still on Facebook dating, on Tinder, on Hinge, or Bumble said that they booted him and will do face recognition to boot him if he ever gets on again. But he was on all the other ones, Plenty of Fish or Match or whatever. But it's like there has to be a way that those kinds of people can be blocked from being on dating sites, because that's where they're getting – that's where they're looking for their victims.
Well, dating sites should be doing –
And that's a really good point, Erin. So to our listeners, if you want to hear Erin's story, go to katu.com and look up Michael Bordellini, and you'll hear from Erin and others about dating websites. And basically what sites aren't doing to keep you safe. So visit k2.com.
Dating sites should be doing a background check, and they don't.
Yeah.
So it's a warning to anybody on a dating site. First of all, predators love dating sites because they're not being background checked and they're not being kept off of them. So it is a very easy place to find victims. second of all, you've got all of these fake people on there. You're not talking to the people who are, you know, they're the people that you're talking to, you know, can be a scammer, can be some kind of a con artist, all of those kinds of dating sites are not where you find relationships. And there are very few people that find healthy people on a dating site. So, you know, in the beginning, dating sites, when they first came out, were not filled with all these predators because it was a new thing. But it is the playground of predators. So stay off the dating sites. Build a relationship with somebody, you know, meet them. And never go, well, how do you meet them? You know what? Figure it out. What did we do before there were dating sites? How did we meet
someone organically out in the wild?
Exactly. and guess what? You get to interview that person face-to-face, and you're not hiding behind a picture who the person that you're talking to doesn't even look like their picture that they posted on there.
Yeah. I've been told by some guy friends that when I was on dating apps to not write anything about myself. And I was like, why? And they said it gives a script for that perpetrator, for that guy or whoever, to become what you want. So they can play the part to get to you and get
didn't
you in
the
draft.
Didn't we learn that in class today, Dr. Mathis? Didn't you bring that up in class?
Yeah.
Exactly what you just said, Erin, Dr. Mathis had in class today.
Wow. And another thing that we need to be making women and men aware that you don't have to have marks on you for it to be rape. I didn't have any bruises. And people were like, well, you didn't get raped then. It's like, no, they can be nonviolent.
Yep.
I mean, and, you know, when you're held against your will and you're, you know, 5'1 and the person is 6'4, you really can't do much against that strength. So, I mean, you don't have to be hit. You don't have to be beaten for it to be rape. And you can be raped in a relationship as well.
Well, then I was just going to say that. And you can be married to somebody who can rape you, and you don't have bruises on you. But no means no. And when somebody says no, or somebody says, I don't want it to happen, or I'm uncomfortable, that still means no, and it means that it doesn't happen. And so, again, people, you know, they watch TV, and they think a lot of things have to be the way they've seen it on TV, and not all things are like on TV. And a predator they think is going to look like a predator on TV. No, they aren't. They're your neighbor. They're your family member. They're your pastor. They're your legislator. They're your judge. A predator comes in every profession and looks like the person next door. And so we've got to get over that stereotype of what a predator is and who a predator is and that we will know them. No, you won't. If they're good at what they do and they've been practicing a long time, you're not going to know who they are until they show you who they are.
And saying, you know, no is something that goes back to when we were talking about the desk deputy. You know, I said no, no, no over and over. And the desk deputy had told the judge that I consented to some sexual acts. And it's like I had an out of body experience. I was like, did I just hear what I think I heard? You threw me under the bus. You threw the victim under the bus saying I consented to some sexual acts when I absolutely did not.
And he was referencing kissing.
Okay, but here again, that deputy, it wasn't his job to put his opinion in there. It was his job to write down what was said. And that's the part that really aggravates me when it comes to all of the people around these cases where they feel entitled to put their opinion in something rather than the facts. You know that old Dragnet TV show, Just the Facts, Ma'am. Well, that's what the job of the police is. What are the facts in this case? Keep your opinion out of it because you're to be getting the facts as they were stated to you into the record.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I said, again, with the judge and the attorney, well, it's been a year. I don't care how long it's been. Keep your opinion out of it. This is a perpetrator. What are the facts? He's a serial perpetrator. It's been proven. You need to convict him. And that's the message that I want people, when they're listening to this, to understand. If you're going through or you've had this, you need an agency like NWK. You need those of us who are advocates that are not afraid to take on systems and people who are not doing their job right, and to hold them accountable as well. We are an organization that's a safe place for you to go to get support, to get counseling, to get help all the way through the process from what happened to you until the court case and then afterwards. And there are very few organizations, of any, that are like what NWK does in the work that we do, because we provide crime victims a place to go where they can receive advocacy and support, and there's no other agency in Washington that's like it. And we are not afraid to use our voices, and Erin is proof of that. Erin has her own strength and her own courage, and she needed people who had their strength and their courage to match with hers to go in and do what was right for her and her case.
For me, like for a victim going into it, I didn't know what was what, and for I would not have, I guarantee you the trial would still be set to continuances if I hadn't met Michelle.
There you
because
go.
They kept on giving these BS reasons as to why we needed to continue, blah, blah, blah. And the last time that the defense tried to pull one on the prosecution, saying that, well, actually, we weren't able to interview this one witness. And the prosecution was like, you're the one that canceled their interview, so this is on you. And then they were denied a continuance. But, like, it's just, they say that the perpetrator deserves due process and everything like that. But it's like, what about my rights and the fact that I want this to be done and not set over for 2.5 years? Like,
yeah, that's called court abuse or litigation abuse, and perpetrators will use it against a victim. They use the court system and the fact that they are bleeding hearts protecting perpetrators. Why does a perpetrator need due process when the facts are the facts?
Facts are the facts, and as I always say, DNA and forensics don't lie. People do.
Exactly.
And it was a prime example of what he did on the stand, looking right at that judge and lying to his face over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
He perjured himself so badly. And folks, if you want to see the entire 4 days of trial and the sentencing, go to youtube.com/NWCave, the number one. Erin, we're at the end of our show. We went over tonight, and you're always welcome back on this show. Any last thoughts?
Thank you. I get that coming forward is very traumatizing and difficult, and being put through the justice system can be very taxing, but at the end, I would rather, you know, say, hey, I went through that and I got through it, rather than regretting the fact that, oh, I should have reported that person and he went out to hurt somebody else. So, I mean, always call 911. I mean, don't be afraid to speak up. This has actually made me, I think, quite a bit stronger. I was not one that spoke up a lot, but this just lit a fire to speak up for the injustice.
You've come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
You've come a long way, and we're very proud of you.
Thank you.
Yes, we are.
You are very strong. And at NW Cave, We believe survivors, and we'll mm-hmm. do what we have to protect your rights just as much as the system seems to protect the criminals' rights.
Yep.
Any last
thoughts,
Kathy?
I wonder if I have clothes to leave the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our Dignity Clothing Program. I'm glad that was a benefit.
Yeah. First of all, I want to thank Erin for being on the show and sharing her story and sharing the courage that she has. It's not easy. It's not easy to come forward. And a lot of people, you know, sometimes the healing process, the more you can talk about your story and the more you can share your story and be around people who believe your story, the healing comes along with that mm-hmm. sooner rather than being ashamed and hiding because you did nothing wrong. The perpetrator is the one who did something wrong, and they're the ones that should be ashamed, and they're the ones that should be quiet. And yet it's always the other way around because victims, you know, have so much that they have to go through in order to prove that they're a victim. So, Erin, thank you yeah. again for being on the show, for setting an example that calling 911, doing all the things right, you can have outcomes that are not going to give you, quote, justice that you might have thought of, but it will give you some kind of conclusion that there's a consequence. And when it's all done and we're all working together to help and support somebody who is a victim of crime, you need to be able to turn to agencies and those of us who understand that process of, we know you're telling a story. We know you need support. We're here to do the best that we can for you. And we're not afraid to use our voices when you can't use yours. Until you can use yours and you can tap into that, you have those of us who are willing to go in and fight for you and to stand up and to say, this is what it is. Facts are facts. You know, DNA doesn't mm-hmm. lie, this kind of thing. People lie, et cetera, et cetera. And we are not going to give up on you. And we are going to be in other people's faces if they don't do their job right, because we believe in holding everybody accountable that supports a perpetrator in that process of justice, whatever we see justice as.
Yep. Definitely. Definitely. And as we close, thank you, ladies, for being with us. And as we close, this week has been a busy week. We Make Media Matter. NW Cave is unlike any other nonprofit organization where we work with the media to give voices back to people like Erin. We have a dream, a world without violence. And since 2012, we've had a dream. And this week, we'll come together on International Women's Day, where NW Cave dreams of a world that's diverse, equitable, and inclusive. A world where differences are valued and celebrated. A world free of bias and stereotypes and discrimination. A world free of hate, inequality, and all genres of violence, especially rape and sexual assault. Our theme is Media Matters. And over 20 years ago, a 14-year-old was kidnapped from the safety of her home. 9 months later, media mattered when Good Samaritans noticed Elizabeth Smart and called police. We are so thrilled that Elizabeth Smart is our keynote speaker this coming Friday to a sold-out crowd at our Java for Justice brunch that will benefit our Advocacy Center for Justice. Elizabeth is doing so great with her foundation, the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. We encourage you to Google it, get to know it. She does so much work for sexual assault survivors. And today, we're going to leave
with a little audio from what's to come this Friday as she keynotes our Java for Justice brunch. Thank you for being with us. This is Spotlight for Justice.
This is Good Morning America.
This is Nightline.
You're watching WISN 12.
The abduction of Elizabeth Smart.
The search for 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart has now gone nationwide.
She was kidnapped from her bedroom in Salt Lake City.
Police say the first 48 hours in a missing persons case are the most crucial.
Elizabeth Smart.
Elizabeth Smart.
Elizabeth Smart.
Elizabeth Smart.
What happened to Elizabeth Smart?
So when I was 14, and I remember crawling into bed next to my younger sister and falling asleep. The next thing I remember hearing was a man's voice saying, "I have a knife at your neck. Don't make a sound. Get up and come with me." I remember getting up and doing exactly as he said because I didn't know if he'd been through my house already. I didn't know if he'd killed the rest of my family. The one thing I did know, though, was that my younger sister was still in bed next to me alive. He led me up behind my house, up into the mountains. I was brought into this campsite. It was very well stocked, very well hidden, and it was this man who had kidnapped me, and his wife was waiting for us there. The woman took me into the tent where she forced me to change the clothes I had on, and then she got up and left, and the next thing I knew, this man was in there telling me I was his wife and then raping me. Then I remember he was kneeling above me and he had this piece of metal cable and he was wrapping it around my ankle and then crushing these bolts into place so that I couldn't escape. And that was the beginning of what turned into the longest 9 months of my life.
Elizabeth Smart will join us this Friday in Vancouver, Washington at our Java for Justice. And just like Aaron, she's a survivor, and both women are our heroes. Good night, everyone. Thank you for joining us.